Good morning, gentlemen. The first thing I want to acknowledge is that the First Friday Breakfast Club is graciously underwriting the AIDS Project of Central Iowa's Stars Party Patron Party. They're our Red Party Patron Party, which is on Friday, April 3rd. And we're especially happy to have you underwrite that that event, because we are honoring David Hurd, which has meant a lot to our organization and has certainly been supportive of this organization. So within the next soon, either through myself as I'm volunteering to do that for the AIDS Project here, because I'm now retired. So either I will send something to you, or I'll have Jonathan, so your addresses can be more anonymous if you prefer that. So thank you, First Friday Breakfast Club. This morning, I get to introduce Scott Schottis. Scott Schottis. I always make that harder. Scott A. Schottis, who is openly HIV positive, is the HIV Project Director at Landon Legal, the oldest and largest national legal organization dedicated to making the case for equality on behalf of lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, transgender people, and people living through impact, litigation, education, and policy work. Scott has successfully litigated cases involving discriminatory denial of medical care to an incarcerated woman living with HIV in Wisconsin. That case is titled Rose versus Kahi. The eviction of a 75-year-old man from an assisted living facility in Arkansas. That case, Frank versus Parkstone Living Center. It just kind of makes me sick to my stomach to think about that. And a member of the legal team represented Lorenzo Taylor in his successful effort to lift the State Department's blanket on ban on hiring people with HIV for the Foreign Service. That case was Taylor versus Rice. In his most recent victory, Scott prevailed in an appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit on behalf of HIV-positive man denied the opportunity to serve on the Atlanta Police Force. That case was Roe versus City of Atlanta. We like the word Roe. That's a good thing for our community. On the policy side, Scott was the point person for Lambda Legal's work on the repeal of HIV travel ban. He presented on various topics related to HIV discrimination, on forums across the country, including as a speaker at the White House, and is working on the reform of laws criminalizing conduct based on HIV status. And I know this afternoon he is going to be talking with Matt McCoy. My guess is that subject will arise, as well. He's going over to the AIDS Project and talking to their director, Rhea Van Brocklin. I'm thinking that's going to be the center of the discussion. Before joining Lambda Legal as the HIV Project attorney in 2007, Scott spent 4 years at Latham & Watkins in Chicago, my hometown. Scott graduated magna cum laude from Georgetown University, the law center there, and clerked with the Honorable J. Frederick Motz in the U.S. District Court of the District of Maryland. So this boy comes to us well prepared. Gentlemen, please welcome Scott Schottis.
Thank you so much, Frank, and thank you, Jonathan, for being such a gracious host. Where did Jonathan go? Ah, he's back there, being such a gracious host. And thank you, First Friday Breakfast Club, for having me, inviting me to be here. I'm actually going to pull this out right now because I know that I'm not going to stay here. There we go. All right. Everyone can hear me, right? And part of the reason I'm not going to stay here is that the remote is now working for the presentation that I have behind you, or behind me. So I'm going to have to walk over there. And actually, it might be good if I'm going to be on top of you if I go to do the presentation from there. So So yes, I worked on all those things, and as I was deciding what I would come and talk to you all about this morning, I thought, well, I could talk about the case that I just worked on down in Atlanta, Georgia, regarding the man who was denied an opportunity to serve on the Atlanta police force. I could talk to you about the denial of surgical services that the woman in Wisconsin experienced. There are lots of very, very serious issues that I could speak to you about with respect to HIV. But I knew that in order to grab at my audience's attention at this time of the morning, that I might want to talk about sex. So that's what that's part of the topic here this morning. Although I will say it is still a very serious subject, or it becomes a very serious subject when it comes to people living with HIV. And I'm going to jump right in here to this presentation, if this mic is going to actually let me get to the board here. So I'm going to jump into the presentation. There's actually quite a bit of material here, and I want to try and get through as much as possible. There will be time, obviously, once I finish with my presentation, for us to do questions and answers. And so whatever we don't get to during the presentation itself, we'll get to during the questions and answers section. So what are we talking about here? I think that people's knowledge around the subject might be quite different. When we talk about HIV criminalization laws, exactly what are we talking about? I do have a slide here about Land Illegal and who we are. If you're not aware of Land Illegal, we're a national organization committed to achieving full recognition of the civil rights of lesbians, gays, bisexual, transgender, and people living with HIV, regardless of sexual orientation, by the way. Sometimes people think we're just there for the gay community, but indeed it's all people living with HIV. And that's through impact litigation, education, and public policy work. You heard Frank introduce us that way. We brought the first HIV discrimination lawsuit in 1983 when we successfully prevented a New York co-op from evicting a doctor who was treating people living with HIV in the lobby of a co-op building. And since then, we've been working on behalf of people living with HIV. So getting to the HIV criminalization point, I want to give you an idea of what's going on out there and what it means when we talk about HIV criminalization. Right now, there is a woman serving an 8-year sentence for a woman alleged not to have disclosed her HIV status before having sex with her partner. 8 years in prison. There was a 25-year sentence imposed upon a man after a one-time encounter involving protective sex. And now some of you in this room may be familiar with this, because this case is actually happened right here in Iowa. And Land Illegal has recently become involved. We've joined the legal team that is representing the defendant in that case, and the case is now proceeding on post-conviction relief up to the Iowa Supreme Court. So if you didn't know about that case, you may be hearing about that case in the months coming up. And we've actually joined a gentleman who's sitting right here, Dan Johnston, as part of the legal team representing the person in that appeal. And then I have my next slide. There's someone serving a 35-year sentence for spitting at a police officer while living with HIV. 35 years in prison for an act that it can't even transmit HIV. It's not even possible. And yet, he's serving that kind of prison time. So we have to ask ourselves some questions, and I use these questions to sort of frame the discussion. The first is, well, what's driving these prosecutions and these extremely harsh sentences? What's behind it? They're nonsensical, so it's good to ask, well, what's behind those kinds of prosecutions? Next question I have is, what are the aims of these laws, and are they advancing those aims? Are they advancing those goals? Are they serving their purpose? These are just some things I want us to be thinking about as I kind of walk you through the laws and how they work. The next question I have is, are these laws fairly distributing the obligations, the burdens, the benefits, and the responsibilities for maintaining sexual health? Because, as we all know, it takes two to tango when it comes to our sex lives. And so do these laws fairly distribute all of those things with respect to the sex of people living with HIV? And my last question, for just keeping our minds, and maybe we'll come back to it at the end, is this an appropriate context
for the state to be regulating it. As gay men, we certainly know from our many years, and this is actually the reason that that Lambda Legal was formed way back in 1973, was we wanted to get the state out of our bedrooms. Because the state wanted to be able to tell us that we could not engage in the kind of sex that we wanted to engage in with the people that we love, or not with the people that we love, but with the people that we hooked up with, quite frankly. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind here, because something that sometimes it feels like the movement is going to this place where we're really working hard to present an image to the world of these monogamous, you know, perfect lives where we live behind a white picket fence and we have a family and we adopt three children. But we're actually here to protect all of our rights, and that includes the rights of people that don't want to be in that kind of relationship, but still want to live their lives and are still gay men and still should be able to express themselves sexually and have the kind of sex lives that they desire. So that is the question: is this an appropriate context for state regulation? And then, if so, is the criminal law the right tool to use to in this context? So this is a quick overview. I'm going to describe the landscape of HIV criminalization in the United States. I'm going to explain why HIV criminalization is actually doing more harm than good. And then I'm going to discuss what is being done and what we can do to fix the problem, although we'll see if we get to that last piece there. So this is a map of the United States. I'm going to take you through this map, that kind of maps out what's happening across the country. Any place that you see a color on this map is a place where there is a problem with HIV criminalization law. So I want you to know that it's not Iowa alone, that this is happening in huge swaths of the country. Although I will tell you that Iowa does seem to be a particular hotbed. There have been, and I don't have the stat right off the top of my head, I meant to grab it this morning, but there have been a large number of prosecutions in Iowa, especially relative to the number of people living with HIV in Iowa. It is second only to Tennessee in the number of prosecutions that have happened over about the past decade. So I'm going to take you through this map a little bit and kind of explain what the different things mean. So, the states that are in red are states with an HIV-specific statute and at least one recent prosecution under that statute. So what does that mean when I say it's a state with an HIV-specific statute? What does that look like? I use Florida as an example, just because it's a representative example. I could use Iowa, and I can tell you more about the Iowa law later. But in Florida, it is a felony, mind you, punishable by up to 5 years in prison and/or $5,000 if an HIV-positive person knows that he or she is HIV-positive, which we should actually be encouraging, right? We want people to know. So that one, not much to get there. Has been informed that HIV may be transmitted during sexual intercourse. Again, something we would want people to know, and we hope that people know. And then three, have sexual intercourse with any other person without disclosing his or her HIV status. Now, what you might notice there is that it doesn't say anything about whether or not a condom was used. It doesn't say anything about whether the other person was actually put at risk and or whether there was actually transmission. Under most of these laws across the United States, there does not need to be an actual transmission of HIV in order to end up with a 25-year sentence of jail time. All there has to be is sex without telling the person. Even protected sex without telling the person, you can go to jail for 25 years. The orange states on the map are states without an HIV-specific statute, but at least one HIV-related prosecution under general criminal law. So what happens in these states is they don't necessarily have a statute on the books that talks about HIV specifically, but the prosecutors pull up something else. Usually it's an assault statute, usually it becomes aggravated assault. Sometimes they'll use attempted murder charges against a person who's had sex with another person, consensual sex with another person. And it goes so far as, in Michigan actually, they have used the bioterrorism law against a prosecution. against someone living with HIV. So those are the states in orange. So as you can see, that covers a big chunk of the country. Then there's the yellow states. Now the yellow states, they have an HIV-specific statute, but they have not had, as far as we can tell, a prosecution under that statute in the time period covered that we were looking at, which was in the past couple of years, like since 2009. But that doesn't mean that there isn't harm from the states that are yellow, because those laws are still on the books. And just like we know in the gay community, you put laws like that on the books and it has an effect. It has a stigmatizing effect, just like we had, there were sodomy laws on the books in lots of places that weren't prosecuted. You know, no one was prosecuting people in a lot of states under those sodomy laws, but the laws were still on the books, and they were still used against us in so many ways. When it came time to adopt a child, well, you know, the sodomy law would be pulled up and shoved in our face and say, and we were told, no, what you do is illegal. Who you are is illegal. You are a criminal, and therefore we're not going to allow you to adopt this child. So just having a law in the book also has an effect. And that covers a large chunk of the country. So I'm going to go through now and explain some of the reasons why. And I think some of these are intuitive. Some of them you're going to get right off the bat. Some of them are not as intuitive. So it might be helpful to think about and to talk about why these laws are not a good thing and why they're actually doing more harm than good. So the first one is, if you'll come up, they're contrary to the goals of public health. Actually, I have them in three categories, and the three categories are things that are contrary to public health, things that are a denial of due process of our basic rights to fairness in the process, and then the serious individual and group harms that they cause. So the first category, contrary to public health, first of all, they don't deter the targeted behavior. The idea, of course, is that we're going to prevent people from going out and having sex without disclosing their status to their partner. And what we've already learned what we can tell from the studies that have been done is that the laws aren't actually changing people's behaviors. Now, there may be a lot of reasons behind that. It may be that some people aren't aware of the laws. But the fact is, what we're trying to do is prevent people from having sex, which we know is a basic human need, a basic biological drive, and that it's very difficult to try and amend those kinds of behaviors. We're talking about who we are as human beings. So what we know is that these laws are actually not doing what they were supposed to do. We also know that they may actually encourage non-disclosure. You might think, well, what do I mean? Why is that? Well, the fact is, and I can tell you as a person living with HIV, that having that information get out there then just exposes you to possible prosecution under one of these laws. So if you don't tell people and you keep it to yourself and you think, well, I'll be able to just keep it to myself, then I can't be prosecuted, right? Because if nobody knows that you're HIV positive, well, then the prosecution isn't going to happen. So they have this perverse effect of actually potentially discouraging disclosure. And it can even happen within the context of a relationship. Let's say you meet somebody and you've had sex with this person, and let's say it was protected sex. And now, after that one time, but you can tell them before that first time, but the relationship goes on, and now you want to have unprotected sex, and or you just want to be able to tell them. Now if you reveal your HIV status, now they have a cause of action against you. Now they can go to the prosecutor and have you put in jail. So there are some real disincentives created to revealing this information by having these laws set up the way that we do. They also serve as a disincentive to HIV testing. The only way that you can be prosecuted under one of these laws is if you know you're HIV positive. If you don't know that you're HIV positive, can't be prosecuted. And so we're not sure yet of the actual, we haven't done studies to figure out how much of these laws are playing into people's decisions. But it certainly is out there, right? And as people become aware of them and become more aware of them, and I think there are some people who think, you know what, I don't want to know. I just don't want to know. Because if I don't know, then I can go on. I can continue having the kinds of sex that I want to have with the people I want to have, and I could not be prosecuted under one of these laws. So they actually act as a disincentive to HIV testing, something that we desperately need people to actually do. For about 20% of the people living with HIV, it's approximated in this country, 20% of the 1.2 million people living with HIV who do not know their status. So we want to be encouraging testing in every possible way that we can. These laws also alienate patients from healthcare providers. So one of the things that happens is that as providers are utilized in the prosecution of these individuals, because that's what happens, right? When prosecutors get a hold of a situation, they get a hold of a situation where they think this has happened, well, then they start going through, they go to the person's doctor. They start going through the person's medical records. They want to know, when did this person know he was HIV positive? What was he told about the transmission of HIV and how that was possible? And they start invading that relationship with those providers. So suddenly, people have their doctors being subpoenaed, having medical records subpoenaed, and having their doctors being forced to testify against them in a criminal prosecution. We'll talk about chilling that relationship, right? You think you're in a space, and we want patients to be able to feel like they can go to their doctor and say, this is what's going on for me, or hey, I had a slip up, and this is what I did, so that their doctor can counsel them, hey, you know, don't do this, or this is how you can modify your behavior, or why don't you think about this? Well, instead, we're starting to chill those relationships so that people no longer feel safe in their doctor-patient relationships. And then this is, I think, one of the big ones, which is it sends a really inaccurate message regarding prevention responsibility. I think I'm in a room with some people that have lived through a big chunk of the epidemic, and I lived through a big chunk of the epidemic myself. And the message has always been that you need to protect yourself, right? That you're responsible for your sexual health, and that you need to insist upon condom use if you want to protect yourself. Well, the way these laws are set up, the message is completely lopsided. It sends a message that you can actually count on your partner to tell you if he's HIV positive or not. Now, first of all, there's a lot of people that don't know. As I just said, about 20% of people living with HIV don't know that they're HIV positive. So we put laws on the books that make people who are not HIV positive believe that there's an obligation. Oh, if he's HIV positive, he's going to tell me. He has to tell me. It's the law. Well, one, he might not know, in which case he has no obligation to tell you. And two, it really just creates this very difficult and awkward situation. And we can talk a little bit more later about just how difficult disclosure is. As a person who's lived with the virus for 13 years, I can tell you that that's not a conversation I ever want to have with anyone. You know, disease is not sexy. So if someone wants to tell me when the good time in my flirtation is to bring up the fact that I'm HIV positive, I'd love to hear when that time is. And yet we place the onus entirely on the person who has the most to lose in the situation in terms of rejection. Not getting to have sex that night with that person down the road, whatever it is, we place all the onus on that person to actually broach the subject. I'm going to jump into some process problems here. The intent requirement has disappeared under these laws. So originally, they were thrown on the books, and I see. Yes, exactly. We're running out of time. These laws were put on the books because we wanted to prevent people from the intentional transmission of HIV. And what happened over the years is that we've lost the intent requirement. I'm going to run through some of the rest of these quickly, and then we can talk more and I can explain more in questions and answers. It is extremely difficult to prove disclosure. So I disclose every time before I have sex with anyone. I can still be prosecuted under one of these laws. Because all it takes is somebody else to go in and say, he didn't tell me. And then we're before court. And we're before court and I'm the guy with HIV. And the other person is this poor, innocent victim of my, you know, deception. Guess who's going to win that he said battle? Not me. This is an example of something that happened to a woman in Georgia who's serving 8 years. And that was despite the fact she had witnesses that came in and said that her partner knew and had been on the front page of her newspaper that she was HIV positive. Didn't matter. She still lost. She still went to prison for 8 years. There's a juror disconnect from other subcultures. This does actually get to an issue that I think could be of importance here. I think that when you place our sex lives and the ways in which we encounter each other and some of the assumptions, hookups online, now suddenly you are adjudicating these things before a jury. Well, I can tell you, I would not want to take my and explain what online hookups are all about to a jury of my peers who are mostly heterosexual, you know, middle-aged, married women. I mean, that can just be a real disaster when it comes right down to it. Let's see. The scientific evidentiary details are ignored, so prosecutors are not put to their proof as to, well, did this person have HIV before this encounter, the quote-unquote victim? And if they do have HIV now, after the encounter, how do you know that actually came from this person? All those evidentiary details out the window. There's ridiculously disproportionate punishment for the crime involved. We can talk a little bit more about this. I think if you're going to prosecute and try and get at conduct that might be is reckless, which I think there's a legitimate role for saying, well, we want to discourage people from doing this, but if we're talking about reckless conduct, we should be punishing it like we punish other reckless conduct, not like we punish attempted murder or murder crimes, because it's significantly different than that. And then I have some individual and group harms. Secondary disclosure. Once you've told someone your HIV status, which you are required to do under most of these laws, there's nothing. Nothing prevents them from doing whatever they want with that information. They have no requirement to keep that to themselves. They can tell your family, they can tell your employer, they can tell whoever you want. And I have a nightmare story about that if someone wants to know more. But we provide them with no protection after we force them to disclose. It can be used as a coercive tool by the HIV negative partner. So this happens, people are in relationships, the HIV negative partner, who knows the person is HIV positive, has been told the person is HIV positive, but now they say, if you don't do X, if you don't stay with me, if you don't, whatever it is that they want, I'm going to go to the police and tell them that you did not disclose your information to me. And it happens. Again, I have an example there. It's really individual lives, as you can imagine, if you are actually unfortunate enough to be subject to one of these prosecutions, it turns your life upside down. Even if you aren't convicted, which most people are, actually, but even if you weren't, your name is splashed across the newspaper, your HIV status is revealed to the world, and it turns your life upside down. It turns sex workers into felons, which is, normally prostitution is a misdemeanor, and yes, there are people out there that are engaged in survival sex work, and those people all become felons. And then finally, I have down here that it stigmatizes all people living with HIV, and this is the example I use with respect to the bioterrorism. So I guess I'm here in part to let you know that there is a law like this in your state, and that there are efforts underway to try and reform this law, to amend this law. We're fighting this law in a lawsuit that's happening right now. And in terms of some of the things that drive this, and I'm going to finish off here so that we can ask a few questions before I depart. There are some basic misunderstandings that are behind these prosecutions. First of all, HIV is no longer a death sentence. And we are prosecuting these crimes as if it was. We're prosecuting them as if once you have HIV that you are going to die. And the fact is we've been able to turn HIV into a chronic manageable condition if you have access to care, which it's a different kind of crime in this country that we don't have access to care for everyone, and in particular for people living with HIV. But the fact is I plan on living a really long time, and HIV is no longer a death sentence. We shouldn't have crimes that treat it as if you just shot the person in the head, which is, I've actually heard prosecutors say, it's the same as if they held a loaded gun to their head and pulled the trigger. HIV is not that easy to transmit.
You won't hear this from public health officials, but the information is out there. It doesn't serve us in our public health messaging to tell people this, but in the riskiest form of sex, which is receptive anal sex, the chances are actually about a 1 in 100 in a single sex encounter. 1 in 100. Most people think that there are about 95 to 98% chance of getting HIV in a one-time encounter. 1 in 100. But we prosecute as if they were, it was a sure thing. The other thing is, if you're undetectable, it becomes downright difficult, actually, to transmit the virus. Once you get to the point where you're on treatment and you're actually much safer, a person's much safer having sex with me and my undetectable viral load than they are having unprotected sex with that person who tells them that they're not, that they are negative and doesn't know and is actually, in fact, positive and is untreated. So, as I said before, I think if we want to punish reckless conduct, we should find a way to, one, treat like harms alike. We should be treating other STDs that cause similar types of harms the same way, and we should be treating reckless conduct with punishments that are akin to that kind of reckless conduct. My example is drunk driving, and we can talk a little bit more about that analogy, but we punish people who go out and engage in drunk driving, but we don't send them to prison for 35 years on the first offense. Maybe if they kill someone while they're drunk driving, we put them in jail for a period of time, but actually the punishments are much lower and much more graduated up the scale. So I hope that there are lots of questions, and happy to take them now.
What is the aisle?
So the Iowa law,
I'm glad you asked, and I'm actually even more glad that I brought it up here so that I could show you. Oh, I had it. Let's see if I can bring it back. So the Iowa law is that it is illegal to engage in intimate contact. Here it is. A person who knows that he or she is infected with HIV commits criminal transmission if he or she engages in intimate contact with another person. And I'm going to skip the next two definitions to tell you what intimate contact means. So intimate contact means the intentional exposure of the body of one person to a body fluid of another person in a manner that could result in the transmission of HIV. Actual transmission of HIV is not a necessary element of this crime. And then it goes on to say it is an affirmative defense that the person exposed to HIV knew the other person had HIV, knew the action could result in transmission of HIV, and consented to the action with that knowledge. Now, a word about that last piece there and just proving disclosure. Unless you're going to pull out the form and have the person sign before you have sex with them, I don't know how you actually go in. And it, because it's an affirmative defense, it's actually up to the defendant to prove that he disclosed. So for people with HIV, you actually need to probably have them sign a form saying that they knew all three of those things before disclosing. Before sex. Yeah?
Could you satisfy the disclosure requirement if you were to say, while the two of you are getting undressed, you know, there's HIV out there, and I'm going to use some protection here before I penetrate you because I'm going to assume that you are HIV positive, and I want you to assume that I am.
I mean, it would be an argument, right? Once you got to court on that, and all the things that you said, it's a very lawyerly thing for you to think of and to say. The problem is, I don't know that whether that would do it or not. It's kind of a non-disclosure disclosure. But there's some legislation right now in Maryland where they're actually going to make their law worse, and where the legislator there has said, well, but everyone knows that a person wouldn't have sex with someone who's HIV positive if they knew. So we deal with that, right, which is, well, if you actually told, if the person actually got from that you were HIV positive, well, then if they were HIV negative, they would never have sex with you. That's kind of the assumption that's behind all of this. Ignoring all of the safe sex, ignoring the reality of our lives, right, which is that there's approximately 1 in 5 gay men in urban populations is HIV positive.
20%. So we don't have the same kind of luxury to think, well, we're just going to avoid people with HIV. It's just really not that possible.
Where's personal responsibility? Why isn't the argument, the story's been out there since 1980. You haven't heard it yet, you might want to wake up.
Yeah, well, I would love, you should come and talk to the legislators in the state, right? Because that's the deal. We've all known for decades now that we are responsible for our own sexual health. And that you can take actions to protect yourself. Now, there are people out there who say, yeah, well, but I don't want to, I only want to engage in protected sex with someone who's HIV positive, and I should have that choice. My answer to those folks is, if you are so that scared of getting HIV even though you're having protected sex, just stop having sex. I mean, in the end, you have to realize that there are risks and there are other things out there. And so you better just sort of take yourself out of the mix because you're never going to be able to completely avoid all the risks that are out there. What about people who don't know? It's just not feasible.
But can't we argue that these laws are pointless? That there's already criminalization of bad behavior?
Absolutely.
So knowingly going around and infecting people, can't you go after them with different...
Yes, you absolutely can. And the arguments have been made. They fall on deaf ears, unfortunately. But we need more people to be making the argument. We need more people to be talking to legislators and getting that these laws are having many more harmful effects, many more detrimental effects than they are positive effects. Do we have another question? I know we're kind of closing in on time here. People need to get to work, right?